And when I asked you some time ago to to note the importance of the various divisions, you noticed that this is a far more important division than the chapter at the beginning of verse 9, and still more important than the one at the beginning of verse 10. In fact, that division at the beginning of verse 10, I think the archbishop's horse certainly must have stumbled at that point, and he made his mark where he didn't intend to, because I can't believe that he would be stupid enough not to see that you have four stanzas, each of them ending with the same phrase, and to put three of them before and the fourth one after with a sharp change of thought before and after this poem of four stanzas. I can't believe he would be stupid enough to do that intentionally. So I feel that it must have been that something happened to make him move hurriedly or turn his attention away from care at that particular point. So we have here what should be one chapter, if you're going to have chapters, beginning at 9 verse 8 and running through 10 verse 4, a chapter with four stanzas in it. The Lord has sent a message against Jacob, it will fall on Israel. Now what is Jacob and Israel? Jacob, as we use the term, we refer to Jacob as the man who was the grandson of Abraham. And we speak of Israel as the nation. But actually, God changed Jacob's name to Israel. And so, in Genesis, there are many places where he is called Israel, and there are other places where he still continues to be called Jacob, even after God had changed his name. And later on, it is quite common to refer to the nation by the term Israel, but occasionally the nation is referred to by the term Jacob, particularly in parallelism. And so I believe in the context here, it is not referring to the individual Jacob, but referring to his descendants, and that these two are parallel. It's Hebrew parallelism. He sent a message against Jacob, it will fall on Israel. But then another question comes to us. Is he here talking about the northern kingdom, which was the greater part of the region of Israel, what we now call Israel was Philistia, but what was then Israel included what they refer to as the West Bank, because it is related to the Jordan, just like California is on the west bank of the Mississippi River. It is the West Bank, but it really was Israel in ancient times, and when the kingdom was divided into two parts, the larger part was the northern, and so it felt it was Israel, and in order to avoid confusion, the southern part is quite generally called Judah. Though after the northern kingdom was destroyed, naturally the southern kingdom again would be what you meant if you referred to Israel. But the word Israel could here mean both parts, or it could mean the northern kingdom. And when you go right on to the next verse, all the people will know it, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, that suggests the northern kingdom. But as you look on through the whole poem, he is referring in the first part to the northern kingdom and in the later parts to the southern kingdom. So I would incline to think that this first part of it, the message will fall on Israel, refers to the whole, and then he talks first about the northern part and then about the southern. Well, he says, the message is sent against Jacob, it will fall on Israel. Then he speaks specifically of the northern kingdom. All the people will know it, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say, the next verse, the bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars. A wonderful attitude. When you have a great flood, when you have an earthquake, when things are bad, you sit down, you don't sit down in discouragement and say, isn't it awful, what can we do? You get busy and rebuild. And you rebuild stronger than you did before. And so if it were not for the part that I skipped, the last part of verse 9, we would say this is describing a very fine and commendable attitude. But unfortunately, commendable as it is from one viewpoint, it is actually an attitude which receives God's condemnation Because it is said with pride and arrogance of heart. If we have a natural catastrophe, if something goes wrong with us because of our own mistakes, and we find ourselves crushed, it is wonderful if we get up and say we're going to rebuild better than before. We're going to make something better than we had before we made this mistake or before this catastrophe came. But if what comes because God has sent it to us in order to show us the error of our ways, then the thing we should do is to repent before Him and to seek His forgiveness rather than to stand up and defy Him and say, well, what we had has been injured, but we're going to rebuild better than before. And so here, this verse 10 would be a wonderful model for us when catastrophe comes that is not due to our sin or due to our mistakes. But when it is said with pride and arrogance of heart, then it deserves God's condemnation. And so it goes on to say how the Lord has strengthened their foes against them, and they come from all sides and they devour Israel with open mouth. For all this, or in all this, I think would be better. In all this, His anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. The Hebrew simply is in all this. Now, the word in there is sometimes used to show the means. By all this would not be out of place. The most natural translation is in all this. The translation for all this is a rather natural guess in the light of context at the end of this first stanza, but it doesn't fit the succeeding stanzas. And so I wish that the King James had been more literal and that succeeding version hadn't simply followed the King James in this translation. You can't be exactly literal in any translation. There are many things that if you just put a word for word into English, they don't make sense. You have to take context into consideration in any translation. But there's no word yet in the Hebrew at this point. And there is the word that they translate for is actually in. Well, in this context with the first phrase here, in all this His anger has not turned away, is more clearly expressed to us by saying for. Yet for all this, God is not satisfied. He has brought these calamities upon them, but they have not repented. His anger is still against them. The yet for, in the light of context, fits perfectly right here, but it does not fit in the later stanzas. And more literally, it'd be simply in all this. And then we go on to the second stanza, but the people have not returned to Him who struck them, nor have they sought the Lord Almighty. So the Lord will cut off from Israel both head and tail. Now there is a figurative expression. The word head, how does a nation have a head? An individual has a head, how does a nation have a head? It is a figurative expression. But whether you should call head a figurative expression is, there may be differences of opinion. Because very frequently figurative expressions come to be used so much that they come to lose the thought of being figures and become literal ways of expressing an idea. And so we speak of the head of a nation. It's originally a figure, but as we use it, it is simply a literal expression. He's the head of this nation. That is a literal expression. But the word tail isn't. That is definitely a figure. The head and the tail He will cut off from Israel. The Israelite, no individual Israelite had a tail. The nation as a whole didn't have a tail. It simply is a figurative way of saying top and bottom. He's cutting off all parts of Israel. He will cut off both head and tail. And then the next two expressions are very clearly figurative. Both palm branch and reed. The palm branch refers to the beautiful top of the palm tree, like the head. It's the beautiful thing that you see there that stands out. But the reed is the little bushes down by the creek. And these little thousands of little bushes down by the creek that don't amount to anything. Well, he says nobody will escape God's wrath. They will not escape it because they are such great, important leaders that they say, oh, well, nobody will touch me. I can run away and take my money with me and be perfectly safe in some other country no matter what happens. No, he says, the head, they will not escape, neither the head nor the tail, neither the palm branch nor the reed. The people in the positions of leadership in most every country that, in which there has been a revolution or an overturning in recent years, the leaders have escaped and taken great sums of money with them and now live in affluence in other countries. He says that is not going to happen there. The leaders will suffer as well as the people. But then you could look at it from the other viewpoint. You could say, well, they'll sweep over the country. They will destroy the leaders. The people that have money, that have influence, the people that have standing, the people that have skill, they'll be taken off into captivity. But the rank and file of society, they will be content, whatever leadership they have. They're not going to suffer in it. He says they will suffer too. Both the head and the tail, both the palm branch and the reed. So there are four expressions, all of which were originally figures, but probably head has become by this time a literal expression, and the rest, the other three are definitely figurative. But the papers that were turned in, most of you did a very good job of noting what were the figurative expressions. There were one or two in which I wasn't quite sure that they understood what we meant by a figure, a figure of speech, a figurative expression. A literal expression is using a word that is commonly used to point to the particular thing we're referring to. A figurative expression is a comparison, usually not expressed as a comparison, but actually substituted for the thing you are referring to. And anybody that says he takes the whole Bible literally, of course, is talking nonsense, because the Bible is full of figures of speech. But very often, a figurative expression is clearer and more understandable than a literal expression would be. So to say you don't take the Bible all literally doesn't mean you don't take it all as true, and doesn't mean that it's necessarily harder to understand. There may be places where figures are very difficult to understand, or where there are different possibilities of interpretation. I like to think of figures of speech as like salt that you sprinkle over a dish. And it tremendously improves the dish to sprinkle a little salt over it. And every writing of any importance has figures of speech in it. But if you pour a whole bucket full of salt on it, you ruin the thing. And so when people take a part of the Bible as entirely figurative, they're reducing it to nonsense. As I read, one man said about the book of Revelation, he said we should remember it is a symbolic book and everything in it is a symbol. And nothing in it stands for what it says. Well, that's reducing it to nonsense. It is a wonderful book of symbols. It has many wonderful symbols. But at least three-fourths of it has got to be literal, or it is anybody can make it mean anything he wants to, if it is all figurative. Mr. Keel?
Yes, what is the difference between figurative and allegorical?
Yes, and allegorical is carrying the figurative idea to a much further point. The figure is a word or an expression that represents something else. An allegory is where you have a whole story in which all of it represents something entirely different from what is originally presented there. And an allegory can mean anything. And if you know what he's trying to get across, then the allegory can increase your understanding of it and be very helpful. But if you don't know what he's trying to get across, you may just as well get something entirely different from an allegory. Yes, Mr. Lake?
The very first thing it says, in one day, that means that on the final day, somehow they broke through the wall, and the whole city was taken off in one day, 24 hours.
Yes, it's just a question how literally you're to take that. The word day, we hear many people, I saw a very intelligent man, a man who has written some very good books about the scripture, wrote an attack on people for taking a stand on inerrancy. And I was amazed at it. And he said in it, he said, people who stand for inerrancy of the Scripture have to do all kinds of twisting, such as saying that the days in Genesis are not days. Well, what do we mean by a day? The common idea that people have is that a day is a period of 24 hours. But if you would write down every time you use the word day for the next month, I would be surprised if one of them referred to a 24-hour period. Day does not mean a 24-hour period. Day means a period of activity. And as used in Genesis, there was a day between darkness and darkness. It was a period of light between two periods of darkness. If I meet you tonight at 11 o'clock somewhere and I say, isn't this a lovely day? You'll say, what you talking about? This isn't day at all. We don't use the word day to mean 24 hours unless we're figuring interest or we're making airplane timetables. Otherwise, we never use it to mean 24 hours. It means a period of activity. And when Jesus said, Abraham saw my day and was glad, he didn't mean Abraham saw a particular 24-hour period. He meant that he saw Jesus' period of activity. And so here where it says in a single day, it in the context clearly means a narrow space of time. But I don't think we can carry it to the point that it necessarily means between two periods of darkness. Now, it might have been, but we don't know enough about the precise details of the conquest to know. Well, then, he continues here. He says, the elders and the prominent men are the head. The prophets who teach lies are the tail. That's a little bit of satire or sarcasm, I don't know which, because these prophets think that they are the people who are giving them true wisdom and telling them what they should follow, when actually Isaiah says these folks are so really unimportant that they can just be considered as the tail. He makes this criticism of the prophets, but he's going to take off head and tail, the Lord will cut off. Those who guide this people mislead them, and those who are guided are led astray. Therefore, the Lord will take no pleasure in the young men, nor will he pity the fatherless and widows, for everyone is ungodly and wicked. Every mouth speaks vileness, yet for all this his anger is not turned away. That's utter nonsense. Yet, in spite of their wickedness, his anger is not turned away. That doesn't make sense. The passage before, he's going to give them this terrible punishment, and yet in spite of that, his anger's not turned away, means he's going to go on to something else. But this stanza describes their wickedness, and in spite of that, his anger will be turned away. His anger's not turned away, that doesn't make sense, and the Hebrew doesn't say that. Somebody long ago translated the first one very well in light of context, and most translations since simply follow it in the other stanzas. But the Hebrew, there's no yet, there's not even an and. And most lines in Hebrew seem to start with and, but this doesn't even start with that. It just says, in all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. In all this wickedness that he's described, his anger is not turned away. Well, we have the other two stanzas, and then we have to go on. And I know you would have a more pleasant Thanksgiving dinner if you were busy working on an assignment to get to me next Friday. But in spite of that, I'm not going to give you one this time. So we will not have any assignment to turn in this week. But if you can look ahead a little into the rest of chapter 10 and 11, just to have it in mind as we discuss it, I think it will add to the value of our next meeting.